Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about Fuente Over Huna by Lope de Vega. Now, I realise that this is not a play that many people may have heard before, but it is a play from the Spanish Golden Age, and I wanted to cover it, really. Not only because, as a play, it's a very good play, but also to talk around the play as well, about some of the technical aspects of what this play is doing, the particular time and place that it came from, and something about the life of Lope de Vega as well, because he did lead a very, very interesting life and was an absolutely immense, very, very prolific writer, writing well over, apparently, 800 plays. We have several hundred of them, not all of them have survived down to our day. But yeah, the Spanish Golden Age. So just for his dates, Felix Lope de Vega y Capio, just known really as Lope de Vega, was born in 1562 in Madrid, 1 year after it was proclaimed the official capital of Spain, and he died in 1635. So for much of Lope's life, he lived through a time of, you know, Spanish dominance in the world. And actually, this entire period from the 16th century to the 17th century, the output plays, creative writing from Spain alone was more vast than the rest of Europe combined. It was a genuine flourishing of the arts, of culture. And obviously, Lope de Vega himself was very, very close to all of this, being in the heart of it, in the thick of it, in Madrid, though not necessarily all of his life. As I say, had quite a turbulent life. He was actually exiled from Madrid at one point in his life because he wrote a somewhat libelous play against a member of the nobility, and so he had to wait for relations to smooth over again for that. Perhaps one of the most remarkable little events in his life was actually in 1588. Lope de Vega himself was aboard one of the battleships in the Spanish Armada. And if anyone knows the history of the Spanish Armada, you know, well enough, you'll know not only was it an English victory, but actually as well that very, very few of the ships actually managed to get back to Spain safely. And fortunately for us, and it is, because if it had died there, we wouldn't have this play now, which was written later in the early 1600s. Lope de Vega managed to survive the Spanish Armada as well. So a very, very impressive man. He was, you know, he was everything you'd expect from a Spaniard as well, you know, living it up in the theatres. You know, he had this whole sort of life that you can now conjure in your head from all those sorts of things. In fact, just sort of codify everything, he was jailed, exiled, married, and on the Armada all in the same year, all around 1588. So yeah, a very, very adventurous life. And his plays are an enduring part of Spanish culture. Fuente Over Huna is amongst his most famous plays, and it's one that I studied at drama school, and so it's actually been a lot of fun revisiting it all these years later to present it to you here today. At the time that Lope de Vega was writing, we're seeing a true transformation of theatre's place within Spanish society, you know, moving away from those medieval centuries where we had sort of religious dramas that were put on by the church And of course, they were a place of high ideals and morals. And, you know, theatre performance was used as a means of moral instruction. Now, of course, that is also true of Lope de Vega's plays. Most plays have some sort of moral lesson to them, of course. But the primary aim of Lope de Vega's plays, and naturally from that, his popularity, was the fact that he just wrote his plays first and foremost as entertainment. He wrote them for mass appeal. A cynic may call them slop, though if they do be slop, they be a very, very high strand of it. It's very, very good. But it is theatre for the masses, all of this to say. And Lope de Vega actually wrote a guide in 1609 called The New Art of Writing Plays, where we'll talk about this a bit more after I've gone through the story with you, but really deconstructing the old way of storytelling, the neoclassical Greek form of plays, and creating what we would think of today as the sort of the new modern drama, the genesis of the new drama. But within his New Art for Writing Plays, de Vega really emphasizes the fact that you need to write first and foremost for your audience. You know what they want, and it's your job as a playwright actually to give it to them. As he's quoted as saying, "We who live to please must please to live." And for those of you who might fairly, you know, criticize for lacking artistic integrity, you know, a sense of bravery and danger and experimentation, and, you know, to accuse Lope de Vega of just playing it very, very safe, we have to remember, of course, the type of people who were attending these theatres back during Lope de Vega's contemporary age, and obviously being a contemporary of Shakespeare too, though naturally the two never met one another, is the fact that these audiences at the time were, you know, labourers, you know, mainly from the lower end of society, and these people could be very, very feral. And if they didn't like what you were performing, you know, food would be thrown at the actors, and, you know, there would be a lot of abuse heckled, and all these sorts of things that seem a bit inconceivable to us today. But nonetheless, Lope de Vega obviously just wants to keep their attention and just keep them happy for a good 2 hours. And that in and of itself does require its own particular type of talent. In fact, to give some sort of comparison between Lope de Vega and Shakespeare, I actually have here a terrific quote from the American literary critic Brander Matthews, where he goes on to say that Shakespeare came forward after the English drama had already developed a variety of forms, and he found the road broken for him by Marlowe and Kyd, by Lyle and Greene. At first he followed in their footsteps, however far beyond them he was to advance in the end. Lope de Vega, on the other hand, was a pioneer. He it was who blazed the new trails in which all the succeeding playwrights of Spain gladly trod. Shakespeare seems to have cared little for invention, borrowing his plots anywhere and everywhere, and reserving his imagination for the interpretation of tales first told by others. Lope, on the other hand, again, abounded rather in invention than in the interpreting imagination. He was wonderfully fecund and prolific, unsurpassed in productivity even by Defoe or Dumas. It was he who made the pattern that Calderon and all the rest were to employ. It was he who worked out the formula of the Spanish Commedia, often not a comedy at all in our English understanding of the term, but rather a play of intrigue, peopled with hot-blooded heroes who wore their hearts on their sleeves and who carried their hands on the hilts of their swords. And I think that that is a very fair assessment, personally. I think that Lope de Vega's place in Spanish culture really can't be understated. So, with all of this lead up to the play and the story itself, shall we begin to talk about what happens in Fuente Ovejuna? Our story begins in 1476 during the War of the Castilian Succession. Alfonso V, King of Portugal, has ambitions in Castile and seeks to establish Portuguese power over the region by ensuring that his wife, Joanna, is placed on its throne. checking Alfonso's strength, stands the alliance of King Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, who marshal their armies, and, in the town of Almagro, the commander of the Order of Calatrava, Fernan Gomez de Guzman, waits for the arrival of the Grand Master, flanked by his cronies, Ortuño and Flores. Upon the Grand Master's arrival, Commander Guzman presses him on how the young master has risen with such prestige. You honour me as you should. How often have I risked my life on your behalf in these dangerous times? And who intervened with His Holiness when the question of your youth put your succession in doubt? The master swears this to be true by the holy crosses that grace their breasts. The commander is pleased and offers him this counsel. Don Rodrigo Teogiron, Grand Master of Calatrava, I remember the day your father gave up that title and proposed that you should succeed him. I remember an 8-year-old boy swearing a vow of allegiance, his election confirmed on oath by a host of high commanders, 6 anointed kings and Pius, the Holy Father of Rome. I remember a boy of 16, weeping as he buried his uncle, his loyal regent Juan Pacheco, Grand Master of Santiago. I watched that boy take up the heavy burden of power, and today I address the youth who must make a man's decision. Since the death of King Enrique, one question has echoed through our land. Who should sit on the throne of Castile? Ferdinand, great King of Aragon, makes his claim through his marriage to Isabella, Enrique's sister. But your family support Alfonso, King of Portugal, and his claim through his wife, Princess Juana, Enrique's only natural child. Blood and honour demand that you support your cousin Alfonso's cause. And to that end, I have come here to urge you, Master, to assemble all the knights of Calatrava and take Ciudad Real, a place of vital strategic significance, forming as it does a gateway between Andalusia and Castile. Minimal forces will be required. The city is defended by a handful of civilians and a collection of minor nobility. Master, it's time to silence those who claim that the Crimson Cross you wear is too heavy for your young shoulders. Remember the Counts of Arowena, from whom you draw most noble blood, and let their triumphs drive you on to heights of even greater glory. Remember the lords of Vienna, and all the brave generals of that line, whose many victories are almost too numerous to be carried aloft, even on the wings of fame herself. It's time for you to go to war, and dip your as yet untried sword in the blood of your enemies. Let its blade match the cross on your breast, for how can I truly call you Master of the Holy Cross when one is crimson and the other white? It's time, Rodrigo, for you to write your own burning page in the proud history of your illustrious kinsman. Duty and honour compels the Master to agree, and the two warriors move to siege Ciudad Real. In the nearby town of Fuente Ovejuna, the peasants gossip about the commander. The town is his fief, and beneath his veneer of chivalry, the townsfolk know his nature as a lecherous and oppressive overlord. He demands the obedience of the women, humiliating their husbands and besmirching their honour. Yet the mayor's daughter, Lorencia, refuses. She has no desire for the commander, or the trinkets he offers in exchange for submission. Lorencia values her honour above all else, and she defends it with a sharp tongue and a strong will. Her closest friend, Pasquale, sees a wisdom in Lorencia's chastity, being sensible of empty promises and the lures of men. Captain Flores arrives in the town and recounts the deeds that the Knights of Calatrava achieved at Ciudad Real. All of its nobles were put to the sword, and its other inhabitants flogged through the streets, the commander being hostile to all notions of clemency. The common people congregate in the town square, awaiting their lord's return. Upon his arrival, he is addressed by Esteban, the mayor of Fuente Ovejuna, and father of Lorencia. Esteban is fawning and offers up many handmade gifts. The commander accepts them curtly, and the townsfolk disperse. Lorencia is then interrogated by the commander, who means to have her, but she resists the attempt to be taken to his residence.
In the next scene, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella discuss their plans for a counter-offensive after a survivor from Ciudad Real recounts a brutal sacking. Act 1 ends with Lorencia and Frondoso by the stream, where the maiden has been washing her clothes. Rumours abound that the two are in love, and they are not unfounded. As Lorencia herself admits, she does feel she possesses many of love's symptoms. Alas, the romance is ruined when the commander approaches and tries to force himself on the poor woman. But she is saved by Frondoso when he seizes the commander's crossbow. Lorencia flees with her honour enduring, and the knight and the peasant are left to confront one another. Peasant out. The girl has gone now. Put down my crossbow. Put it down. Do you hear me, boy?
No, my lord. A man in love is deaf to all insults, and I'd be a fool to put this down. You'd just pick it up and kill me.
Do you think a man of my rank could turn his back and walk away? Retreat before a peasant child? Stand fast and shoot me through the heart. I won't break my oath of chivalry.
I don't ask that. I understand the obligation of your rank, but I've my own obligations, one of which is to stay alive. So I'll take your crossbow and leave.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.